Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Headwinds in Lab and Path. The presenter is Michael Ferry, MMMBA, President, Laboratory and Pathology, Coronis Health, Fenton, Missouri.
Okay, let's go ahead and get going. My name is Michael Ferry. I'm president of laboratory and pathology for Coronis Health. Quick background, been doing this a long time. I think the birthday of the company is tomorrow. It's 27 years. The legacy company, I should say, that was originally referred to as Physician Data Management, or PDM. So I'd like to welcome back to the stage, so to speak, having come out of having worked with BioReference. Jane Pine Wood is here to join us today, and we're going to tag team on a series of questions and comments and issues and things like that. So slides are broken, but it really doesn't matter because neither of us like to talk to slides. It just doesn't really fit in how we do stuff. But when we published our agenda through the War College, we listed several things that we thought people would want to talk about. But one of them, sort of at the end, was current events. We're actually going to start with current events, because there's a lot of current events going on, things that are really, really important to this community. The first of which, I'm just going to run through them, and then we're going to work them our way through them. One is the FDA final rule. There's a lot of people who will be having stomach acid over that. I think it was only like 528 pages, short document. I'm sure Jane has already committed all of it to memory, as last night. But we're not really going to talk about that here because Jane's going to talk about it this afternoon in copious detail with Valerie. I guess Valerie's going to be with you on that. So we'll sort of punt that one down the road a little bit. One that's really important is the Department of Justice's view into COVID and recouping money. We will definitely talk about that. That one's, if you read that document, it's about six pages, it was not a pleasant document. Equally unpleasant was the advisement by the OIG, 2306, that talked about relationships between laboratories, which was maybe, in my years doing this, was probably the worst thing I've seen in a long time. They were really specific about how you could potentially break the law. We're going to talk a little bit about the FTC comment on non-competes. It seems to be obviously a big issue for a lot of people in this business. They all want to know if they can violate their non-competes now. And that seems to be, it's a hot topic, let me tell you. Every time I turn around, somebody, what do you think about this? And then we'll talk about the Texas challenge. So the Attorney General of the state of Texas has challenged reimbursement under Medicaid. And this is sort of like Medicaid Part 16, I think. This has been going on for decades. Good morning. It really has been going on for decades. What was the guy's name? I was starting to think about it. That started all the lawsuits in California and across the country.
Chris Rydell.
Those of you who were in California will remember Chris. But Chris started all of this 15 years ago, maybe, by suing for LabCorp and Quest and everybody else for the way they contracted and the way they accepted payments less than Medicaid. And he was a great whistleblower, and he retired many times over, basically, because of that. So anyway, let's get into the first item that was actually on the original agenda, which is the audits are coming. They're not just coming, they're here. And they're here in a big way. And it's really important that we focus on what they mean. Obviously, the Department of Justice coming out over COVID.
I'm going to stand over here because I hear the people over there, so I'm going to be on this side, I think.
It's like stereo.
I know.
The biggest audit probably right now is the Department of Justice's audit. That's a huge, big issue. And I'm going to punt that directly to Jane for the legal implications of it.
Okay.
And,
do you mind if I digress a little or things like that?
I know I can't control
okay.
that.
So maybe it's, and Michael, I think I'm going to go back because as we were talking last night, sort of, you know, preparing for conversation today, And as Michael said, a lot of these things have circled around. And I think in setting the stage for everything we're going to talk about for the audits or the government's position, it's really important to think about where we're coming from out of the pandemic. And particularly for, these are not activities necessarily the people in this room, but what else is going out there? Because you have to understand now, the government is looking through everything with the lens of what are all the new to laboratory industry people doing. So if we go back during COVID, as you're all aware, you know, you could find, I mean, particularly I was in New York City during that time, you know, every street corner had at least one or two testing labs on the street corner. They're billing for everything, and they're billing the HRSA fund for everything. They're billing insurance, and they're doing, you know, three tests at a time typically. I mean, I know the one on the block where I was, if you went and said you'd been exposed to COVID, and you got your rapid PCR, your rapid antigen, and an RT-PCR. And that's just what they did as a matter of course. So you have also all these people who came into the laboratory industry during COVID with the pop-up COVID testing who have absolutely no healthcare background and no laboratory background. So I told Michael last night, there was one when I was working in-house during this at BioReference, and there was one of our sales reps came up to me and said that there was a lab that needed our help. They were a brand new COVID testing lab, and I'm doing my background to figure out, you know, who are these guys and what's their background. And I kept seeing the names come up running a whole series of car washes. And so I went to our sales rep and I said, well, you know, what's going on here? He goes, yeah, no, they do run, they have car washes. So they're really, really good at drive-through things. I was like, okay, you know. But those are so many of the people who came into laboratory testing during COVID. And importantly, the government through HRSA, as well as private payers, pretty much paid for everything without asking questions, given that was during a pandemic and the concerns about having testing done. Well, now we're back to the old rules again, which is you don't get paid for testing unless it's medically necessary. If you can't prove it's medically necessary, then you have the dollars recouped. On top of a lot of new people who we don't necessarily see every day in what I'll call traditional laboratory pathology medicine, who were part of this wave of people coming from other industries doing testing, and now the government's looking at what they were doing and realizing they were billing them. Either they were shysters or they just didn't know what they were doing and they were billing improperly. But many of those same individuals now think that they can move and take their same equipment and move to PCR testing, move to genetic testing. So there's a whole new group of players out there in the industry now who would not have been there necessarily pre-pandemic. And unfortunately, for everything that we're doing, the government is looking at it through the eyes as if everyone is one of those players new to the industry. So that's my really long diversion. Sorry. So the Department of Justice has announced that it is definitely looking at COVID testing, among with other dollars spent in COVID. This isn't just laboratory testing, nor is it even healthcare. I mean, the government is looking in general at all the dollars that were spent. And they're looking at where dollars were spent inappropriately, who charged inappropriately, recouping the money. So the government is on a tear right now with the COVID testing, and particularly testing that was billed to the HRSA fund. So in this situation, I think we should all expect, if you haven't already, audits from the government if you had a lot of COVID testing. But even more than the government, I'm seeing some of the private payers come in and start looking. And again, we can all have different philosophies about what level of COVID testing, you know, did someone have to have? Would screening tests have been covered or not? What about nursing home patients? You know, should that have been covered or not? Regardless of who's coming in, just be aware that there are a lot more audits on the COVID testing. What's different this time is, again, this is the reason I'm going back to look at all the people who were in the industry with the testing before. What do you need to do? Because in the past, if you were audited, you may have said, okay, we got a request for medical records, or we'll send in our medical records, we'll send copies of the requisitions in. Again, what's really important here is they're looking at you as if you were one of those labs on the street corner in Manhattan, and that you were testing everyone and billing everything to insurance without even asking if the patient was symptomatic or had been exposed to COVID. So you want to, if you build insurance and if you're audited for this or the HRSA fund, make sure to show a requisition. If it is signed, that is perfect. If your requisition is not signed, make sure that you go back to the ordering clinician and try to get some kind of attestation or something where that clinician says, yes, for these patients, I ordered the testing. Trying to make sure there's some ICD-10s that go with it that look like they might have been covered. You know, I mean, if this was billed with a screening ICD-10, that's going to be a problem. The test report, ideally, but in the days of COVID, this was really hard, didn't see it much. If someone was positive, what was the follow-up with the patient? Because there's a difference between someone paying out of pocket for a COVID test, taking the answer and just going. But if you're billing insurance for a test, the expectation is, if that test, like any other test, is positive, where is the follow-up with the patient? Or at least to offer some kind of counseling for the patient somewhere. Anything you have like that, it's going to be important to send with the initial tranche of information. Don't just send some reports and wait for them to come back and ask questions and ask for more documentation, because chances are the second communication you get is the recoupment notice. And then it's really, you're going to be really behind the eight ball getting information on that.
So I think that to go parallel that, I think the thing that we see more and more that's actually becoming a little alarming is that a request for medical records really no longer includes a requisition and a bunch of paperwork. They want to go back and see the notes that came out of the clinician's EMR. And for laboratories that we worked with, I don't care what side of the house you're on, CP or AP, that's a little hard to get. I mean, people don't want to cooperate. I mean, it's not that they don't want to cooperate, but they're busy. And isn't that your problem? And shouldn't you have asked for that originally and blah, blah, blah. And that makes the audit process 10 times more difficult because you know you're innocent. You know you did all the right things. You have the signed rec, blah, blah, blah. But it becomes a snowball, basically. And it puts people in a tough position because then they have to spend a lot of money to go to her because that's your only way out at that point, which is to justify yourself.
Well, to Michael's point, if I think back, probably when I was giving the same talk 30 years ago at this conference or 35 years ago, I talk about if you're audited, what do you need to provide? You need to provide a copy of the order, and then you need to provide a copy of your test result. So, and then let's say, okay, well, I'm giving the same talk, 15 or 20 years ago at the same conference, it was, and you probably need to get the medical records from the doctor showing the medical necessity for ordering the test. As I sit here today, I say the last thing you need, and really one of the most important now, is the medical records from the physician's office showing that the physician looked at the results or someone in his or her office did and how they followed up with the patient. And one of the reasons this is particularly important, and again, I'm going to go back to what environment are we in now and what happened coming out of COVID, is if you just Google OIG or prosecutions and pharmacogenetic labs, and you will see that there has been a flurry of criminal, not just civil, but criminal prosecutions, criminal sentencing against laboratories, laboratory owners, sales reps on pharmacogenetic testing. And a lot of this during the pandemic, a lot of it was pivoting to use equipment that people bought and like, here's some money. Let's go to nursing homes. Let's go to senior centers. Let's go to all these places where older people congregate. And basically what's being offered was what we would all consider screening genetic testing. But the people doing it thought they were being smart because they said, well, you know what? We can bill this to insurance. We can bill it to Medicare. Because Medicare will cover certain genetic testing as long as you have some family history. Well, if you're going to a nursing home or a senior center and you're talking to people who are older, one, they may not have a real clear memory of family history or their own history, but at that point, there's probably someone in their family who has developed something. I mean, someone can probably come up with something generic to show that there was family history. In many of these, it's a remote physician who is doing the ordering. No physician saw the patient. They're just going to a community center or going to a nursing home and signing up patients and saying, do you want a test? This is great. Medicare pays for it. It's not going to cost you a thing. A remote doctor is doing it. They may have had someone doing some quick histories on a checklist, and then no one's really following up with the patients with the results. The other thing that was happening was a lot of the telehealth, not the legit telehealth companies, but there were certainly many others where during the pandemic, people got very used to going online and getting healthcare online. So they could order their tests online, their genetic, their cancer screenings. Get your genetic cancer screening test. telemedicine physician is doing the ordering, but it's usually asynchronous, meaning there's an intake from the patient goes on and clicks a box on the website of what my family history is. No one's taking it, patient's just self-filling it in. Someone looks at it later on the back end, and 99.9% of the time approves the test, then submitted to insurance. Again, no follow-up with the patient. So with that in mind, and there have been, again, as I said, quite a few criminal prosecutions and sentencing of laboratories engaged in that, and importantly, against the physicians as well who were doing the ordering, saying that they were complicit in the false claims because they really didn't see the patient or have any physician-patient relationship. The government is now looking at this with the assumption that someone's trying to cheat the system. That's one of the, so there is a reason that they are looking for the follow-up records after the visit. Importantly, when you're audited now, don't just send in or have your billing company may automatically have a protocol to send in the test results and the order. That first tranche of information really has to have physician medical records, because you might not get another bite at the apple. They don't necessarily come back and say, can you give us more information? They come back and say, oh, now we've taken that, and now we've extrapolated it. Oh, and by the way, you now owe $1.7 million that we're recouping. And at that point, it's very difficult to walk things back.
Exactly the case. I never thought I'd actually see the thing about what did the doctor do with the result, but it actually has happened. It's like, what does that have to do with anything? It actually now has, it's going to have more and more to do with it. And if you think it's difficult getting the record before the test, you can't imagine how difficult it is to get the record that the physician did something with the test, because sometimes it really doesn't even exist. That's a problem.
And just to follow on that in a moment, for some of this we're talking about if you have audits, how to deal with it. But also for those of you in the audience, if you have some of these telehealth, or a lot of them are people who are in tech industry and they're moving into what can we do in terms of healthcare and making healthcare more accessible for patients who want to do direct to consumer. Be very careful, because since I've been back in private practice now, 3 months, I suppose, I have gotten a very large number of calls from people asking about setting up more of a direct-to-consumer testing, which, okay, patients are paying, they pay online, like, no, we're going to bill insurance for it. And once these are people who, again, they're not trying to do something wrong, they just don't know enough. They have not been in the healthcare industry. A lot of them are people who've been in tech, and they're young, and they're in their mid-20s or late 20s, and they're trying to do that transition into healthcare. And they don't understand that a screening test, or just because someone wants something, or just because a physician orders it, that's medically necessary. And a lot of them are reaching out to laboratories because they want the labs to be the back end. I mean, they're just the platform providers. They're not the testing labs. So if you are approached by anyone who would like you to be the testing lab for their healthcare platform, and if they're talking about billing insurance in particular, be very wary, because particularly if they're using your contracts, if you're the one billing insurance for the testing, they may not have any of this medical record documentation. There may not be any follow-up with a patient afterwards. Now, I've seen some that are very legit. They may be using, you know, like a Teladoc. And Teladoc, is a telemedicine provider with, beginning to end care. And there is follow-up. And there are people who have their remote physician who becomes their remote physician. Those are a little different, but I'm looking at more of the ones where you're like, this doesn't feel quite right. Payers are really suspicious of those now, and you don't want to be the one holding the bag if your insurance contracts were used to bill for the work.
Okay, we're going to change subjects, because we could talk about this forever, and this building's not tall enough. So let's go on to how low is too low. This is an issue that obviously is becoming a big issue in the state of Texas, just down the road. It's a gigantic big deal. As I said earlier, it's Chris Rydell, Part 17. And I think the thing that we need to be worried about is that we all have to be almost careful where we're stumbling these days. Because it's not just Texas. Connecticut has a perfectly horrible law in place that makes just your fee schedule a huge big deal. It used to be when we did these fee schedules and we had all these laws and everything around the country, it was like, well, it was most favored nation status. It's like it was on a charge basis. The state of Connecticut entered the scene with, no, It's on what you get paid. And they've actually had commentary out there talking about that, well, it's any deal that you cut. Whatever is the lowest deal you cut is the lowest price that we want as the state of Connecticut. That's a problem. First of all, they ask for reporting. Secondly, they ask you to prove it. It's really hard to do if the truth be known. So I don't know if you have any. I know you have comments about Paxton, but.
Yeah. So as most of you know, in many states, there is a Medicaid law that says, you know, thou shalt not charge Medicaid more than you charge anyone else. And there are different variations. Some of them say you shouldn't charge Medicaid more than you charge the general public. Some of them say to other private payers. There's variations. And that is important because of variation. Texas has a bit of a middle-of-the-road law. It's not as strict as some, bit of the middle of the road. Some of this is public knowledge, some of it isn't. Ken Paxton, the Attorney General, sued LabCorp. This is public knowledge because these, you know, it's been reported because they're in litigation. And so there have been rulings issued as they're working. I think they're probably about 18 months, 24 months into their litigation. In addition, Ken Paxton, the Texas Attorney General, is investigating, you know, most of the other large laboratories who would be providing services to residents in Texas. The proposition they are taking, that the Texas AG's office is taking, is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas managed Medicaid. Superior managed Medicaid in Texas. They pay less than Medicaid. Well, yeah, we all know managed Medicaid pays less than Medicaid. Well, these labs agreed to take less than Medicaid, so they should have charged the Medicaid program in Texas the lower fee. It's the first time I've seen a state, if they've looked at the lowest of the low Medicaids, because usually they're looking to say, what have you charged, you know, a hospital, or what are you charging others? You should give Medicaid the best pricing. Here what they're taking is what those managed Medicaid plans are reimbursing, which most labs have no choice in the matter. You want to be in network, you take, Texas Blue Cross Blue Shield. You want to be in our network, you take the rates. You don't like the rates, you don't have to be in our network. There is no real agreement to accept those rates. You're forced to take the rates if you're going to be in network. This is not yet resolved, but it is quite worrisome because now you have that precedent, and now it's a public precedent because, you know, this is going through litigation that people are seeing, where other state attorney generals are likely watching to see what comes of this, because it's a very interesting twist, because I suspect in every single state with a lowest of the low Medicaid law, there are Medicaid managed care plans that pay less than Medicaid. They almost all do. I don't have a resolution for it, but just be aware of it. Also, if they're looking at ways that you might be able to assist if you ever get caught up in something, making sure that when you submit the claim to the Medicare program, if you can submit that claim at your usual and customary fee schedule charge, rather than submit the claim for the dollar amount Medicaid pays, because we all know they'll go ahead and pay the lower Medicaid rate, but you at least have a position to take, no, we charge everyone the same. Same with the managed Medicaid. If you charge, if you drop your claim for the same dollar amount for everyone, we just know it gets paid at a lower amount, you can try to use that argument, no, we charge everyone the same.
Quick and dirty topic, FTC ruling.
Oh, yes.
Because everybody should care about this.
Yeah. So the Federal Trade Commission is very concerned about non-competition restrictions and, you know, whether they're impeding the ability of employees to pick up and move around to other jobs. So if we look at two types of contracts in particular, one would be your employment contracts, you know, with your personnel, you know, with pathologists, with sales reps, with scientific personnel. Or it could be in your hospital contracts, where the hospitals say, we want to hold a pathology group, for example, to a restrictive covenant, so that you don't go work for one of our competitors as well. So those are the areas where it's most applicable. And what the FTC has said is that non-competition agreements, not confidentiality, not non-solicitation, so we'll talk about those. But for the non-competition agreements, it says, if you leave your employment here, you leave your contract with me, you're not going to go work for another laboratory for 2 years. Or the hospital agreement, your Part A agreement that says this group, pathology group, cannot go work for the hospital across the town without our permission. FTC, I guess the rule was announced last week, so 120 days from whenever, I think it was last Tuesday, was, is the effective date of a new rule which says, in general, those non-competition agreements can no longer be enforced. And so, but again, we know it will be challenged. In fact, challenges are already being filed, so we'll see where things play out. But the important thing is two parts. Government has said, well, what non-competition agreements can be enforced? There's no grandfathering here. So if you have them in your contracts, they're not going to be enforceable unless we see some legal challenges that have injunctions tied to them. And in 120 days, or within the 120 day period, you have to give notices to your personnel to let them know that those non-competition provisions in their employment contracts are no longer enforceable. FTC's website has a model form that you can use to give it. And they said that if you use their model form, you're protected, it's a considered adequate notice. So who's exempt? What if the FTC rule gets through without challenges or without injunction? What non-competition agreements remain? Only those with senior executives. And senior executives are defined as those people making more than about $153,000 a year. It's some odd number that must be inflation adjusted, or I don't know why it's not an even number. But it's around $150,000 a year, and they have policymaking authority. That, I mean, to have... The $153,000, you're like, okay, I can capture all my pathologists there, I can capture most of my sales reps there, but the policy-making authority is the real key. And that one's going to make it, this means you're really talking senior leadership in a company. Now, on the flip side, if a hospital has that restrictive covenant that you can't go work, that non-compete in an agreement with a pathology group, it will not be enforceable if the hospital is for-profit. The FTC does not have jurisdiction over not-for-profit entities. So the FTC has said, we cannot make a not-for-profit hospital or not-for-profit entity comply with this new rule. So that's a really weird, and I think that may be, you know, some of the legal challenges, and that this is really setting up a weird marketplace. What is enforceable? You can still have non-solicitation agreements that say you won't go solicit our customers. It's going to be really important in your contracts to look, if you have employment contracts with restrictive covenants that just say you can't go work for another lab, you need to start thinking about how are our non-solicitation, confidentiality, trade secrets language. Because the FTC did say those are all enforceable as long as they are not so absurd that they actually are effectively a non-compete. I mean, there's a point at which the government, they haven't really defined that, but there's a point at which they may say it's so absurd. But if you're concerned about this, take a look at your standard contracts, and if you don't have some strong non-solicitation language, usually about 2 years is the most you can keep someone from soliciting clients, or good trade secrets, you won't take client lists, you know, you won't take our fee schedules, you may want to start thinking about those really quickly within the next couple of months.
Arrangements that create problems. There's a lot of those out there. We deal with them on the billing side. We deal with them all the time because people come and say, well, we're going to do this. And it's like, no, you can't do that. Fortunately, I was trained by the best to be able to at least identify when something smells a little fishy. But I think that there's at least two of them that are particularly difficult for labs. ECRA has created quite a stir and always creates problems for people, and creating, particularly for their salespeople, what's, you know, how do we compensate you? I don't know that there's anything that's new and different in ECRA. It's just there. I think the only thing about it is, unless I've missed it, I don't think there's been any enforcement. I don't think anybody's done anything with it.
Yeah, ECRA is hard. Whenever there are groups of healthcare attorneys who represent laboratories, we have sort of a working group of attorneys from major firms around the country. And we get together once a month, and we sort of go through, you know, de-identified, but legal issues that have come up, keep each other informed of what's going on. The hot topic is always ECRA. I mean, because in any room with healthcare attorneys, we're all like, oh, God, we hate ECRA. You know, it's just such a pain. Because if you look at ECRA, the way it is worded, it would prevent you from paying commissions to your full-time employed sales rep. I mean, that's a ridiculous outcome. Every other sales rep in every other part of healthcare gets paid commissions. But if you can't pay your full-time employed sales rep commissions, budgetic's quite a disadvantage. In addition, there is a safe harbor under the anti-kickback law that does permit you to pay commissions to your employed sales reps. So now you have these two federal laws. There are two cases so far under ECRA. They're not enforcement from the government. These are just, you know, civil cases where ECRA was people basically trying to set aside, you know, contractual agreements. And they went different directions. One of them had commissions paid to a sales rep. It's like, hey, that's fine. That's no problem at all. No big deal. Does not violate ECRA. The other case said, yes, it violates ECRA. But it's in the situation what lawyers call bad facts make bad law. It was a salesperson who was also the owner of the company who was engaged in securities fraud at the same time. So it was one of those decisions. When the court was looking at everything to invalidate the position of the other side, they're like, well, he clearly was a crook. I mean, truly a crook. So it was easy enough to say, oh, yes, and by the way, his activities violate ECRA. There are activities going on behind the scenes right now in terms of discussions with the federal agencies, discussion with Congress, and teeing things up for potential legal challenges. So at least in those discussions with Congress and with the agencies, they also know that things have been teed up for possible legal challenge. I think it will be a couple of years before we see things come through. So when people ask right now, well, what do I do? In talking with these legal groups, most of the laboratories, certainly most of the medium to larger laboratories in the country, they only use W-2 employed sales reps. They're not using independent contractors. Do they pay commission or variable compensation to their sales reps? Yes, they do. Are people going to come out and raise their hand and say, yep, yep, we pay commission? No, they're not going to say it. But everyone knows, yes, most people are paying commission to full-time employed sales reps who go through compliance training. Their activities are regularly monitored. They're strong compliance programs. And as we've done the surveys of attorneys, does anyone support commissions or variable compensation to an independent contractor, particularly these marketing companies, independent contractors? And the answer is, I haven't found an attorney in the last 12 to 18 months who would support paying commissions to an independent contractor. So if you have any of those arrangements or if you're approached with them, a flat fee could work. I mean, there are ways to compensate and to use someone who's an independent contractor, but the commission arrangements now are really viewed as suspicious. But there's a second reason beyond ECRA, and it goes back to the first thing we talked about. In all those cases I talked about where we have a lot of criminal prosecutions now going on because of what was perceived as fraud with the COVID testing and some of the pharmacogenetic testing, what they have also done is most of those used independent contractor sales and marketing companies to push the work and or to, you know, engage physicians to order the testing through some kind of asynchronous ordering or to recruit patients. And the government has said those activities, because they were paid commission, they were really directing the work, those sales reps, those independent contractor companies, and that violates the anti-kickback law. Because the anti-kickback law isn't violated just by ordering a test. It can be violated by directing the flow of work. So all of those cases involved the anti-kickback statute against independent contractor sales reps, and that has upped the risk factor significantly.
So we'll get back to that in a minute, but we want to talk about the advisory opinion last year, 2306, which was very, I mean, if you've read it, 6 pages of pain. But it was very specific.
Come on, lawyers love that thing.
It's very specific law. It was very clear about what the fact pattern was. Yet the result was, I think, was alarming. I mean, it did tell you what you can't do anymore. That's for
sure. Advisory opinions are interesting. Advisory opinions, technically, this is if someone says, I want to ask the government to rule on something. And if you're asking for an advisory opinion, typically, you want something that says you can't do it because you're using it for a competitive reason to say, hey, we're not doing it, but look, doctor, you can't do it either. So an advisory opinion, the government will say, is not law. They say it's simply our guidance in how we interpret the law. But keep in mind, we're in a very different environment today than we would have been even 5 or 10 years ago. And the government is looking very hard at the anti-kickback law, at criminal prosecutions under the anti-kickback law because of all the fraud and improper activities that went on during the pandemic. So when you have an advisory opinion, what it means is government now says, you're all on notice of how we interpret a law. So if we actually investigate you, you can no longer claim that in good faith, I thought this arrangement was fine, or my legal counsel thought this arrangement was fine, or I have a, you know, something my lawyer helped to set it up 10 and 15 years ago. Because I will say, in our firm, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we set up arrangements which are now implicated by that advisory opinion. Times change. But the government can now say, you are on notice. So if you have continued the arrangement after our advisory opinion, you now have improper intent. And if you have improper intent, we can go after you under the anti-kickback law, regardless of what your attorneys or other people may have said 10 and 15 years ago. And that's the reason the advisory opinion is so important, because you're all deemed to be on notice. So what does the advisory opinion say? It's a fact scenario that even, you know, 10 and 15 years ago, when we had clients, a few who asked about it at the time, we said, you know, this is probably something the government wouldn't like, but you can make it fit within a safe harbor. So you have the GI group, and they have their technical component lab. Well, let's say this is the fact scenario that was proposed. The language of the advisory opinion is broader. So the fact pattern was GI group has an in-house technical component lab. Payers are not going to reimburse them for the work because the payers are very concerned about overutilization. So now the GI's got this lab, Medicare will pay them, but Blue Cross and Cigna aren't going to reimburse them for the work. So they go to their local pathology group that's doing the professional interpretation, split billing initially, pathologist billing professional, GI group billing technical, and saying, well, you've got the contracts, why don't you buy the technical from us? If you buy the technical from us, you can bill globally those payers. There's a safe harbor to cover purchased services, and as long as the payment is fair market value, you'd say, okay, this should work. You know, we check all the boxes on the safe harbor. Not really what the government or people would want, but should work. The government has now said, no, no, no. Even if that purchase arrangement is for the commercial private payer work, the purchasing, they call it laboratory, but pathology group, you know, they are only doing it to get the Medicare work. The only reason they're going to buy that technical from the GI group is to get the referrals for the Medicare, for the professional component. Otherwise, you know, many of them have their own lab. Why would they be buying the technical from a GI group? Or they buy it from another independent lab, probably at a lower price. So the government has said this whole arrangement smells, and we think it's improper. They danced around whether or not it fits within a safe harbor. They're just sort of taking the position of this can't be fair market value arm's length, because that is a requirement of the safe harbor. Fair market value arm's length. They're like, this isn't arm's length. It's only entered into for one reason. So I think we can look at that and say, I could sort of see where the government's coming from if you take the GI group, who Cigna's not paying them for their TC and they're trying to sell it, and they're going to send the work to whoever buys the TC and bills globally. The language of the advisory opinion is a bit broader. They talk about Lab A and Lab B. When you read it, you think, oh my gosh, the words of this could actually apply to your traditional reference referring lab relationship. You've got two labs, one buys work from the other. Do I really think the government's going to go after those at their arm's length, two just very traditional reference referring lab purchase service? I don't think so. I mean, I think there's such a long history, because I think that the difference, and this is what we're saying in our firm when people ask about it, is if you have a laboratory and you want to offer a full suite of services, and you may have a test that you are not doing in-house, and you want to buy that test from another lab to complete your menu because you don't offer it. And you know what? You're going to shop really hard for the best price. And chances are you probably don't send any work back to whoever you're purchasing it from other than that test or sample test you're buying. That doesn't seem to raise the issues that the government said gave them stomach acid. So even though the language of this advisory opinion would appear to be broad enough to cover a traditional reference referral lab relationship, as long as you're not playing games with it, I don't think there's much risk. But if you have a situation where someone's specifically going out and saying, you know what, I can do these IHCs in-house, but maybe I'll go home and buy them from that small lab, because if I get the IHCs from them, they're going to send me all this other work, even though I can do it in-house. I have the capability. There's something you have the capability to do in-house and you're doing, but you go and buy it from someone else, that's where I think you might want to look again at the relationship to see could the government view that as analogous.
The thing that was oddest to me about it was that it was, if the fact pattern was basically that they did it just to get paid. And I've heard that a few times over the course of 27 years. And you know, when those words appear in an email, that's when you have to stop people from hurting themselves, because you might as well just start slashing your wrists, because that's what's exactly what you're going to do. The other thing that implicated that in that law, in that advisory opinion that was interesting, is that they implicated AKS, and then they implicated false claims. They lined up all the laws at one point to cause you to pay great fines and serve jail time.
Right.
I mean, it was clear.
Yeah, the government's approach, and again, I know I keep hearkening back to what changed in the pandemic, and I think it is this overreaction to what truly was across the board, not just in healthcare, not just in laboratory, a lot of fraud with government funds during COVID. So the enforcement now is looking at, if we're really going to change behavior, we cannot just fine people. You know, money, people come up with money, they pay it, that doesn't change the behavior. It is very, very much internal directive from the government, which is we have to go after individuals and you have to go after people criminally. Because unless they go after people individually and criminally, it really doesn't change behavior. And again, my concern as a lawyer is that for any of my clients, if they're under investigation, I get worried that the government is beginning with that, you know, that set of glasses viewing everything through, that these are all bad apples, and not recognizing that the bad apples are only a very small number. It's not the people who are attending this conference.
Jane, do you think that, this came up a question, random question last week, do you think whistleblowers play as big a role today as just the government out fishing?
I think whistleblowers are still a big part of it. So when the government does its reports and how many of these come from whistleblowers, it still is a huge percentage. The government still has strapped resources. So in general, the government isn't going on a lot of fishing expeditions, but if they have a whistleblower and if they find success in that area, what they will then do is data mining to find others who may fit similar profiles. So the government isn't necessarily finding the first problematic case. Those are usually coming from whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are typically former employees, sometimes current employees, but usually former employees, as well as competitors. And those are the typical whistleblowers. And in fact, the government has just, not necessarily in healthcare, but across the board, has boosted some of the reward that whistleblowers can get, recognizing that this helps the government quite a bit to have someone else build their case for them.
So we don't have a lot of time, but there is one subject that comes up more frequently now than I've seen it forever, really, is how all the laws work together. So I get caught on AKS, and then false claims comes along, and then they throw in a little start because they have nothing better to do. And it's a triple threat, really. And they're getting good at this. Maybe they didn't care before, but they're getting much better at this than they used to be.
They're getting much better. I mean, we do have, on a federal and state level, a lot of different laws. They are not all consistent. For any of you who've been doing this a while, you realize the laws are not consistent. You comply with this one, and then you find you're not in compliance with that one. The government, and again, this happens, it's not just in healthcare. You know, these laws get passed at different points in time. I mean, just look at ECRA. You know, and what it's done is inconsistent with the anti-kickback statute, which would permit commissions to your employed sales reps. The government can pick and choose. And when we say the government, what's difficult here is who's bringing a case or who's doing the investigating. We have the federal government, DOJ, OIG. And again, a lot of those are still whistleblowers. They're looking at the federal statutes. So they're looking at the anti-kickback, or if you're dealing with physicians, the Stark Law. What they now say is if you violate those laws, the claims you submit are also de facto false claims because the underlying premise violated a law. So those are false claims. So now you get the False Claims Act penalties. If you're looking on a state level, if you have Medicaid or managed Medicaid, Those are government programs. So now you get the anti-kickback statute, and you can get STARK, and you can get the Federal False Claims Act, in addition to whatever state law there is, because there are many comparable state laws involved. Private payers going after activities, because we've also seen an increase with the Cignas, United Healthcares, and others. Let's just say that sometimes when they have payer issues and they're going after and they think there's inappropriate behavior, it is a bit uncanny that within 3 to 6 months there may be a government inquiry regarding the same behavior. So, you know, what you know is yes, the payers have the back door to the government officials and they're saying, hey, we got a problem with this lab. Can you, you know, go check into it? They're using the government to do some of their dirty work for them, I believe. We also have situations where at least one individual who's a medical director for one of the national health plans is also a well-known whistleblower. And I suspect strongly, I'm not the only one, that this individual medical director probably utilized a lot of the data to which she had access in her role with that payer to build her whistleblower cases, although I've never seen that she's ever had any retribution, you know, nothing done with her about that, but I suspect she did.
Anything about TCPC splits that we haven't talked about?
I would say if you're my preference in today's world, given the audit environment, is everyone should bill for the services they're doing. I would prefer to reduce as many purchase service arrangements as possible, but if you do have them, let's look very closely at them, document well the fair market value. Just anytime you have money flowing between you and someone else for services, it is a point at which someone could try to point fingers or find a problem. It's not to say that they're improper, but my concern about them is heightened now given the environment we're in.
So just last week, with a client going through relationships and billing stuff back and forth, client billing, and we kind of accidentally stumbled on maybe not always billing back all of the TC to the hospital for the DRG and the APC both. And this fact pattern is going to be, in fact, we'll be talking, you and I will be talking about this, but it's a little bit on the edge, but it did heighten everybody's alarm, which is, oh gosh, we didn't realize that's really what we were doing here. And I don't know if people miss that these days, but I know that it has some heightened sensitivity.
Yeah, I think given, although what we've seen from the government enforcement lately has been relationships between laboratories and physicians. That seems to be most of the focus. But certainly we all know that if you're dealing with pathology groups and their hospital contracts and hospitals who probably aren't paying you enough Part A, or they may be beating you down to make contributions, or if you're providing technical component services to the hospital, they're beating you down or pricing, or they want you to throw something else in, you know, to sweeten the pot. Again, although the government doesn't seem to be focusing on those relationships, we are in a heightened environment, and we do know a lot of things come about through whistleblower actions. So if there is a silver lining to all of this, if your hospital contract is coming back up for renewal, I might say, listen, hospital, you got to be careful about what you're asking us to do because you are the referral source to us. And if we start to give you too many benefits, look at what's going on in the enforcement environment. I mean, this is one of the few times that I might be able to use government enforcement to a benefit, and then I can say to a hospital, we just need to be much more cautious and make sure that the pathologists are compensated fair market value for what they're doing, and not try to drive down the pricing, which again has been traditionally what hospitals have done with their pathology groups.
Send-outs, good topic, because someone just asked me on Friday about the 30% rule. The comment was, it seems like everybody's forgotten that rule. And I went, really? Because I didn't think there was anything we would forget there. And but you don't really hear about it in terms of enforcement, or you don't really even hear it as an issue, it's legally.
No, I haven't heard it as an issue. So the 70-30 rule for clinical lab services, and this is important, it's a rule that only applies to clinical lab services. A laboratory should not bill the Medicare program for any testing unless it performs at least 70% of the requests that come in its own laboratory. meaning there's a cap on how much you can send out. It's 30%. If you exceed that cap, you're technically not entitled to bill Medicare for anything. What I'm really curious about here, and again, I haven't asked me, have I seen enforcement on this? Do I see people looking into it? No. But if I go back to all these labs that popped up during COVID, and a lot of people who were billing pass through for testing, and they're billing Medicare program for some of it, I tend to wonder at what point will someone on a Medicare side realize, oh yeah, there's also that 70-30 rule. Now we can recoup all of their Medicare billings, because if they exceeded it, maybe we get to recoup everything. Haven't seen it yet, but.
You're right, because.
They say test. This is so old, they just say test.
Right.
So, you know, I think one could play CPT or test code, but if someone's really getting close to it, might want to be careful. Again, I can't point to any enforcement on this. I mean, this lab came about probably in the 1990s. It was part of the PAP mills. This is going back a ways. And so it was designed to prevent the shell labs for the PAP smears, a very specific evil. But it's sitting out there, and if I were on the government side, I think there could be a lot of application to it.
Clearly, I mean, I know a lot of people that pushed out a lot of COVID testing, and if COVID was the exception to everything, they might not go after it. But they are going after right now COVID stuff that I never thought we would see.
Do I have like a minute to talk about
yeah.
one other COVID thing, which I think is getting a lot of questions
about?
Nobody's
trying to kick us out yet.
Yeah, so as I hear things. Okay, so we all know that during the pandemic, CLIA, CMS was much more flexible with CLIA and says, okay, you can do, you know, so we have the digital issues, and we still know that we have, under CLIA, you can still have digital interpretations as long as the remote site is tied to your main CLIA location. What doesn't exist anymore? There was a Stark waiver in place during the pandemic that is no longer in place. So if you have so I'll go back and blame the GI group I was blaming before. If you have a GI group and they had hired a pathologist to do interpretations on their behalf, and during that pandemic, if that pathologist was remote, one could say, okay, CLIA permits the remote interpretation. The Stark law, because typically the Stark law would require the pathologist to be on site, that Stark waiver is in place. Now, there also is a Medicare anti-markup rule that still would have required on-site interpretations, but let's just sort of ignore that one for a moment because it's a pandemic and no one cared. The Stark waiver is gone. So I run into groups that say, well, no, it's okay. The pathologist will say, no, we're still remote because CLIA permits us to be remote. It's like, yeah, CLIA permits you to. The Stark law doesn't. That waiver went away. So for any of you who are, again, I'm only talking about where a GI group or a urology group or a derm group has hired a pathologist to do interpretations on their behalf. That's the scenario here. And just be aware that Stark waiver under the pandemic is gone. So most of those arrangements are going to require that the pathologist is back on site to do the interpretations. It doesn't apply what you're doing in your own practice if you're billing.
Any, like, last-minute remote questions, anything, before she exits the building? Well, not
here.
The building, but maybe the room. All right. Thanks, everybody,
Thank you.
For coming. Appreciate it.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.